You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show was also brought to you by our Patreon supporters, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Scurvy Pete, Kane, Kinway, Hefei, Zuman, Blacktip, Matthew the Navigator, LeChuck, Bull, Vertigon, Conif Allende, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. Last time, the pirates under Captains Francois Groynet, Pierre Le Picard, George Due, and Mathurin de Martet attacked the city of Guayaquil and what was then the Viceroyalty of Peru. Edward Davis, captain of the frigate Bachelor's Delight, was rushing up from the south from the city of Paita to aid the other pirates against a Spanish armada. Now, we talked about the discrepancy between Ravno de Lusan's account of the battle and the reality of the fight. Lusan couched everything in terms of valor and glory, which was far from the truth. Today we'll continue with that comparison, only instead of valor and battle, it will be a look at plunder and the power of French amour. This is episode 71, Dice for Your Life. The first few hours immediately following the conquest of a city are the most important. Even if you lay down perfect plans, see to every small item, cross your T's and dot the I's, triple-check every detail, even then, there will be mistakes. A city under occupation is tense, but usually quiet. A city that just lost a battle, though, well, if the conquering force has a fearful enough reputation, one might see women flinging themselves and even their children from the walls to avoid their attentions. The pirates weren't as feared as all that, but they were still reviled and despised and seen as a monstrous terror, devils in truth. The pirates, though, acted quickly to subdue any resistance in Guayaquil. Their main goals were to keep the local grandees from escaping and to stop any treasure from falling behind the sofa. These pirates we're talking about, they were most concerned with the treasure, at least at first. Ravno de Lusan tells us about the treasure that they took immediately after their victory in Guayaquil, and you wouldn't believe the riches they found. He writes, quote, "A great many pearls and precious stones, a prodigious quantity of silver plate, and 70,000 pieces of eight at least, though there were 3 millions among them when we came thither. And a vermilion eagle gilt that served for a tabernacle to some church, weighing 68 pounds, as well for 2 rocks of emeralds, where the eyes of it were made." End quote. That's a great treasure indeed. 70,000 pieces of 8 pearls and stones and a 68-pound gold eagle. But wouldn't you know it, quote, "The masters of the forts laid hold of that opportunity to make their escape along the river with the greatest part of their most valuable movables. When our canoes were come to anchor under the town, 4 of them went away in pursuit of the sloops that carried the said riches of the town away. But then it was too late." End quote. The pirates grabbed what they could, immediately, in town. But even more important than the booty was the capturing of prisoners. They had the soldiers already, but the populace was still running free. They took anyone of consequence hostage and marched them to a nearby church and locked them inside. This was pretty typical practice for the pirates. They intended to capture the people and hold them for ransom. Finally, though, they made their way to the governor's mansion. Lusan writes, "We found this governor's house so richly furnished and filled with such precious movables that nothing in Europe could be more magnificent." End quote. Now that's not true. Versailles existed, but the governor's house still must have been pretty nice. They agreed with the governor on a price for all of the goods they held, for the families in town, for the town itself, for the fort and all of its munitions, for the cannons, and for the ships in the harbor. They agreed on 1,000,000 pieces of 8 in gold and 400 sacks of corn. This left the pirates with a few days of hard work ahead of them. They had to patrol the streets, they had to set guards on the prisoners, and finally, they had to transport all of their goods that they had taken back to the boats and then back to the ships. Now, the pirates shared the work out equally among them, so that they all had some time in town. They all had to labor, but they all could enjoy the pleasures that Guayaquil had to offer. Revenot de Lusson tells us that the women of the town were very beautiful. They had been misled by the fathers of the town into believing the pirates were inhuman monsters that would kill them and eat their babies. However, and my voice cannot drip with enough sarcasm to give this next passage its due, the women of Guayaquil, according to Revenot de Lusson, had, quote, horror and aversion for us, that they could not be dispossessed thereof till they came to know us better. But then I can boldly say they entertained quite different sentiments of our persons, and having given frequent instances of so violent a passion, as proceeded sometimes even to a degree of folly. End quote. Once they got to know us, you know what I'm saying? You picking up what I'm laying down? Yeah, you know what I'm saying. Ha ha! If you aren't smelling what Lusson was cooking, he breaks it down further for you. Quote, some of our men grew very familiar with our women prisoners, who, without offering them any violence, were not sparing of their favors. After they came once to know us, they did not retain all the aversion for us that had been inculcated into them when we were strangers. End quote. All of this has the ring of some sleazeball in a bar who failed to seal the deal, and bragging later on to his buddies. Yeah, you know how those Spanish girls are, they can't get enough. Lusson tells us of one woman in particular, a beautiful young Spaniard, a gentlewoman, a handmaid to the governess, in fact. He was marching her to one of the churches when, quote, she turned back and with tears in her eyes told me in her own language, Señor, por l'amor de Dios, no me como. That is, pray, sir, for the love of God, do not eat me. Whereupon I asked her who told her that we were wont to eat people. She answered, the fathers, who had also assured them that we had not human shape, but that we all resembled monkeys. End quote. He infers that this beautiful gentlewoman learned firsthand that he was very much human, and that she showed so violent a passion for him as proceeded even to folly. Then he spins out a great yarn. That young gentlewoman, with tears in her eyes, was the wife of the treasurer of Guayaquil, the same treasurer of Guayaquil that had been killed when the pirates attacked the day before. As you might imagine, once this young widow, who had lost her husband yesterday, found out that Lusson wasn't a cannibalistic devil monkey, she jumped right into his arms. Lusson's charms were so great that, quote, now that woman appeared so far comforted for her loss that she proposed to hide me and herself on some corner of the island till our people were gone, and that then she would bring me to Guayaquil to marry her, that she would procure me her husband's office and vest me in his estates, which was very great, end quote. I try to avoid swearing on this show. I do. Kids might be listening, and even though we talk about beheading from time to time, my language is something that I can control, but sometimes it's so hard. When the right word is there, right in front of you. If this were Sunday school, I might say that Lusson's story is a big old pile of manure. And look, there is the question of publishing. A good French story, one that was going to sell anyway, had to have a little bit of everything. Religion and patriotism, which, if you remember the attack on Guayaquil, his story had in spades. It had to have an anti-Spanish propaganda, which is what this entire story is about. It had to have some good old-fashioned blood and violence, and then just a little bit of sex. Otherwise, it wouldn't be exciting. And in Louis XIV's France, actual concubines were the norm, at least among the classes with enough money to buy books. Everyone had extramarital lovers. If your husband didn't have at least one mistress, most wives would be a little embarrassed. Your husband must not be handsome or charming enough to attract anyone else. Often, wives would ask their friends to introduce their husbands around, and if you were a woman whose only relationship was with her husband, well, the shame would just be too great to show your face at the salon. This kind of makes sense in a world where marriage was about property rights and alliances. Love was a thing for peasants or for concubines. And most audiences in France would eat that story up, a beautiful young Spanish bride falling for the French conqueror. Of course, those Spanish hussies gave their violent passions so frequently a turn to folly. I mean, French men are just so handsome and virile, they couldn't help it. But let's remember here, Spanish colonial America was not Paris. However nice the governor's house may have been, it wasn't Versailles. And these Spanish women were not Parisian gentry. They were wives, and they were mothers, and they were daughters who had just seen a group of violent Frenchmen kill their husbands and sons and fathers. That treasurer's wife that proposed to Lucan only a few days after her husband was killed? That's not how human beings work. That is not a situation conducive to willing concubinage. I mean, sure, maybe 300 buccaneers defeated the entire 700-strong Spanish army. Maybe they sallied forth with drums drumming and trumpets blaring and chased the Spanish army from fort to fort. The pirates did have a reputation for winning battles, especially on this voyage, so maybe that reputation preceded them. And then maybe they did take the opportunity to pray in the local church. They were legitimately pious Catholics, most of them. They were sinners, obviously, but they observed the forms of Catholicism. And then maybe there was more than 3 million pieces of eight in treasure lying around Guayaquil. It was a rich city. The Spanish did have a history, even, of escaping with most of a city's wealth just in the nick of time. I could suspend my disbelief to that point. Bravery, victory, and riches beyond belief, and then a moment of piety. I could go there. But those exotic Spanish women taking the pirates to bed willingly, even proposing marriage to them and offering them their husband's former office? Perhaps there were women in Guayaquil, most of them slaves or the town's sex workers. Perhaps they were encouraged to entertain the pirates. That would have gone far in the interest of preserving the honor of the town's more respectable Spanish ladies. That's no better, but it may explain those violent passions. But let's remember, aside from the violence and the killing of Spanish soldiers, these men weren't Orlando Bloom here. The pirates that came in and sacked Guayaquil had been sleeping rough for years. They never ate properly. They were haggard men. They were almost certainly missing teeth from a lack of citrus, and most of them hadn't had a decent bath in some time. So, I find all of this very, very hard to believe. This is a story. A story written to sell books, and it's not a bad story. In many ways, it's a perfect French story. You have to remember that the French at the time, and we're going to be talking a lot more about this in the days to come, were at the top of the world. These pirates were pirates and not exactly noblemen, but the French nation was the most rich and the most powerful and the most populous of nations in this decade. Those Parisian women who would have been reading these stories enjoyed reading stories about brave, handsome, dashing, roguish young Frenchmen overcoming the reluctance of the Spanish women. The French men who would have been reading this story, most of them, their husbands, would have enjoyed those stories even more. They would have been able to visualize themselves, also brave, handsome, and amorous Frenchmen, into the stories of these pirates. It's not unlike Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones is handsome, worldly, well-traveled, and always gets the girl. James Bond is another good example of that trope. These pirates, according to Ravenaud de Lussan, filled that niche in the storytelling world, and these stories sold well. But we have to remember that there is very little, virtually no, historical documentation to back this up. The Spanish don't have records about their women falling into the arms of the French. Even if it did happen, and I don't believe it did, they wouldn't have written that down. So all we have to go on is the word of one man whose interest was more in selling books than historical accuracy. However, the events that follow do have corroborating Spanish sources, so let's move on. After about a week of the pirates in Guayaquil, a fire broke out in the city. Lusan assumed at first that it was reckless pirates that left a fire unattended. But the fire hit the granaries and the storehouses. The pirates fought the blaze and got it under control and finally extinguished, but a lot of goods and food were destroyed. Lusan says a third of the town was burned down, although the Spanish records say a bit less. Here's the problem with that. The pirates' agreement with the governor stipulated that Guayaquil go unharmed. If it burned, their agreement was nullified. The pirate captains had given strict instructions on the matter not to leave any fires unattended. So, Pierre Le Picard, George Du, and all of the officers save Francois Grenet went to go visit the governor. Grenet had been wounded in the battle and was resting up with the other wounded men. The governor, when they went to meet him, was imperious. He was furious, and he insisted that his agreement with the pirates was void. But Pierre Le Picard countered, "It's funny how the storehouses that burned just happened to be the same storehouses in which all of the goods belonging to the pirates were kept. Their corn, their 400 pounds of corn, which was intended to feed them, all of their spices and dyes and sugar and coffee, all of that which was to be sold, most of that had been destroyed in the fire. A fire that, according to the agreement, released the town from paying any ransom to the pirates at all. What an inconvenient coincidence that turned out to be." The pirates suspected the governor of, quote, "a mischievous intention to burn the merchandise and corn that were of so much use to us," end quote. So Picard informed the governor that if the ransom were not paid in full with an additional sum to replace the lost food and goods, he would see 50 heads sent on to the governor's mansion. If that failed to encourage compliance, Picard said, he would see that the pirates finished what the pirates assumed the governor's agents had started. They would burn Guayaquil to the ground. The governor insisted that the entire incident must have been some, quote, "rascally, spiteful people that had done this, and he would take care to satisfy us," end quote. The governor furnished the pirates with a brand new ship and the men that were needed to load up all of the goods and the treasure that the pirates still held. They could take their ease in town. They could enjoy their time in the city, you know, with those violently passionate women. Right about this time, Edward Davis was engaged in a battle with that Spanish frigate out in the bay. Now, this battle was happening way too far away for the pirates in Guayaquil to hear or see anything, so the pirates didn't know what was happening. But those lookouts that were left out in the bay by Francois Grenet did bring word of a Spanish frigate and a small fleet entering the bay. So Picard, who was second in command, sent enough men to crew a bark and to deal with any Spanish presence that might be lurking around in the bay. On the 2nd of May, Francois Grenet finally succumbed to his wounds. He had taken a cutlass to the leg, and that was in the rain and the mud during the attack in Guayaquil. Finally, that turned infected and killed him. Before Grenet had died, he had given orders to Pierre Le Picard, his second-in-command, and Picard had been seeing them out. But now he was in command of all of the forces in Guayaquil, and he ordered them out of the city. He wanted the pirates to return to their ships, anchored off La Puna Island. Their plan was to wait on La Puna for the ransom from the governor to be paid, but they did at long last have ships full of cargo and food from the city. Picard was a cautious pirate, but a prudent one. He wanted to be prepared for whatever might be coming for them. Their island was safer. They were nearby their ships where they could defend themselves better than they could in Guayaquil. The last orders given to the governor of Guayaquil was for a small unit of Spanish soldiers to carry all of the gold and silver and pearls that were to be paid as ransom to the pirates. But the deadline for that came and went. The pirates agreed to allow the town 4 more days to pay the ransom, and 4 days later, that Spanish squadron did arrive. Now, they weren't carrying chests of gold to the tune of 1 million pieces of eight. They were carrying an officer and a few soldiers and one prim bureaucrat. These Spanish men informed the pirates that the ransom was coming. They didn't have any reason to worry, but, you know, these things take time, so why not just kick back and relax? That ransom will be here soon. If they had, in fact, encouraged some of the local women to entertain the pirates, this may have been the point, to buy them time. However, Picard saw through this. He ordered the Spaniards captured, and then, quote, "Now this made us suspect very much that there was some treachery in the case, and that they entertained us with hopes for no other end than to amuse us till such time as the enemy were reinforced, insomuch that we were constrained to use severity towards our prisoners, which we knew would strike a terror into our enemies. We made them dice for their lives, and the lot falling upon the heads of 4, we cut them off presently and sent them to Kayakia in the same vessel that had brought the said officer unto us." End quote. Once again, the governor made an agreement upon receipt of the 4 heads. He agreed to send them 20,000 pieces of 8 immediately. The pirates agreed that upon receiving it, they would leave Guayaquil and Guayaquil Harbor forever. The following day, while they were waiting for the ransom, one of the barks that they sent out to scout for Spanish Navy ships sailed into view. The pirates on board told Captain Picard that they had indeed seen a frigate out there, much too big for them to fight. That bark ran for it, but the frigate chased them around the bay and then finally out to sea. Now those pirates gave that frigate the slip and came back to talk to Captain Picard about what had happened. Unfortunately, they hadn't actually given it the slip. Only a few hours later, the lookouts spotted sails on the horizon coming to La Puna Island. One of those scouts in the bark confirmed that it was the very same frigate that had chased them earlier. Apparently, they had been followed and found. Now, this put the pirates in a difficult situation. A frigate like that could tear them apart. They were in periaguas and barks with only a few heavy guns. Their biggest ships were that half-galley and one of the sloops taken in Guayaquil. They could run. They were faster than a frigate. But that monster was blocking their way out of the bay. One way or another, they were going to fall in range of her guns. Now, some of the men argued that the pirates should all return to Guayaquil. At least there would be walls for them to hide behind, but Picard put the nix on that. The governor was stalling them. There was clearly an army on the way to Guayaquil. With this frigate here and the potential of more ships to come, they were trapped. Their best option was to fight their way free, to take their plunder and escape the Bay of Guayaquil and the army that was certainly coming to crush them. Then another ship did appear at the mouth of the Bay of Guayaquil. This one, a fat merchantman, trailing the frigate. That merchantman stopped at the larger ship and then set sail toward the pirate vessels at La Puna. When she got in close, Captain Picard saw that they were, in fact, Englishmen, not Spanish, and that they were led by none other than Captain Edward Davis. That frigate that had given them all such a scare was Bachelor's Delight. Now, Captain Davis had the entire crew of that dreaded Spanish frigate in captivity below his decks. He told the story about fighting that frigate, running her aground, capturing the prisoners. And Picard realized that Davis had fought and bled to keep the French pirates on land safe, to guard their rear while they attacked the city. So everyone agreed that he and his men, all of the pirates on board Bachelor's Delight, had earned shares from the raid on Guayaquil. But Captain Davis had one other piece of news. That fat merchantman on which he sailed over to meet the pirates had been sent out of the city of Guayaquil clandestinely and slipped past the pirates, but Captain Davis had intercepted her before she got away. The captain of that merchantman carried a letter from the governor of Guayaquil, who had just made another deal with the pirates, to the viceroy in Lima. It read, quote, "Sir, I am to inform Your Excellency that the English and French are still at Pune. It's several days since the term they had allowed us for the redemption of our prisoners is expired. I have done it on purpose that Your Excellency might gain time. They have sent me 4 of our people's heads. I will amuse them with some thousands of pieces of 8 from time to time, though they have no reason to be wary, while Your Excellency may please to come. And though they should yet send me 50 heads more, I shall esteem that loss to be much less prejudicial to us than to offer such evil dispossessed people to live. Now, sir, we have a brave opportunity to get rid of them, provided Your Excellency lose no time to do it. End quote.
Napoleon Bonaparte rose from obscurity to become the most powerful and significant figure in modern history. Over 200 years after his death, people are still debating his legacy. He was a man of contradictions, a tyrant and a reformer, a liberator and an oppressor, a revolutionary and a reactionary. His biography reads like a novel, and his influence is almost beyond measure. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast, and every month I delve into the turbulent life and times of one of the greatest characters in history, and explore the world that shaped him in all its glory and tragedy. It's a story of great battles and campaigns, political intrigue, and massive social and economic change, but it's also a story about people, populated with remarkable characters. I hope you'll join me as I examine this fascinating era of history. Find The Age of Napoleon wherever you get your podcasts.
Now that letter's only source comes to us from Lausanne, not the official Spanish record, and I find it suspect. By suspect, I mean it's too perfect. The governor comes right out and says he is plotting against the pirates. He's callous and indifferent in how he brushes aside the beheading of his citizens. Now, I wouldn't put that beyond a commander or a governor of any colony to feel that way, but I would put it beyond them to say it. And then he goes on and says that the pirates have no reason to be wary. They were sending the pirates food, so that might be all that he was talking about, but then Ravenau de Lausanne follows this up almost immediately with an account of his days on La Puna. They have music, Lausanne says. They have lutes and guitars and harps, and then they have all of those concubines with which to pass the days. These are the prisoners, some of them, that they have with them, and yet he says that they are more than willing to entertain the pirates. That's what the letter's real author, Lausanne, is referencing when he says that the pirates have no need to be wary. He doesn't want us, the reader, to forget how all the women just fell in love with the pirates. He tells us of his days with the treasurer's wife, and how, finally, he informs her he cannot stay. In form, at least, it's almost like some chivalric poem, but in substance it breaks down basically to, "Sorry, babe, I'm a ramblin' man." That entire letter, I believe, was fabricated by Ravenau de Lausanne to add a sense of legitimacy to the story that he was telling. Then, a few days later, the very same merchantman that carried Captain Davis returned. This time, though, she carried word of a real Spanish armadillo. Remember 2 episodes ago when that Spanish admiral sent a few of his ships away to search for the pirates elsewhere? Well, none of those vessels had found any pirates, and they all returned to Drake's Isle, as they were instructed to do, only to receive word from a messenger left on the island of a pirate attack on Guayaquil. The merchantmen brought in word that 2 small fleets of galleons and sloops and barks were closing in on the pirates. Now, Picard hadn't been idle this entire time. The men may have been enjoying wine and women and music on the beach, but Picard had outfitted 2 of the prizes taken in the raid on Guayaquil, a Spanish man of war and a sloop of war. They were respectable enough warships, but not enough to carry all the French pirates, and not enough to take on all of the Spanish galleons. However, they did still have Bachelor's Delight. So Picard ordered 80 of his best pirates to board her, to fully man the best ship in their fleet. Then he put the rest of his best pirates on board that man-of-war and that sloop, and then he gave Jean Rose command of the merchantmen. That fleet, Bachelor's Delight, the Spanish merchantmen, the man-of-war, and the sloop, were all gunned and fully crewed. But that still only carried a fraction of the pirates there in the Bay of Guayaquil. Most of them were still on board periaguas or canoes. Those pirates took on whatever cargo they could carry, the most valuable cargo among the pirates. Several thousands of pieces of eight in gold and silver and the pearls and the rubies. They took all of that and rowed their boats into the shoals and the flats where the armadilla couldn't follow. The pirates then chose to dump most of their prisoners on shore, and they actually gave them orders to wait on the ransom that was coming and collect it to give to the pirates. Presumably, the pirates also left all of their concubines on shore as well, although at this point Lusan fails to mention them. You see, at this point he's past the kissing parts and now it's on to the fighting parts. Those four pirate ships sallied forth to meet the Spanish. In the age of sail, a battle at sea was kind of like a dance, maybe a tango. It's all about the chase. But they could take hours. Most of that time was spent sailing around, vying for position, trying to get into place for a decent shot. The actual shooting could be minimal, sometimes non-existent. Now, not the really big wartime naval engagements between great powers. When armadas of ships of the line clashed in large numbers, there was almost constant firing until one side was too beaten down to continue. But when a few smaller vessels met, it was usually mostly a struggle to get off that one perfect volley. Unfortunately, that means that stories about battles in the age of sail can be dull. They can take more than hours. They could take days. When those four pirate vessels sallied forth, the armadilla was waiting for them at the mouth of the bay. It was there to block off their escape. See, there were more ships and an army coming down to reinforce Guayaquil. All that this armadilla had to do was keep the pirates here. Whenever those four ships would approach, they tried to slip through this Spanish blockade, but those Spanish vessels shifted position and stopped the pirates dead. They would have them at a disadvantage. They would have them in range of their guns if the pirates continued on, so the pirates stopped and turned around. Now, there wasn't any shooting on that first day, just attempting to find a way to slip past the Spanish. At least there wasn't any shooting until after dusk when Bachelor's Delight signaled an end to hostilities for the day by firing off a volley, and everyone, including the Spanish, lay anchor. The next day, everyone got up early to start the fight, but they found themselves becalmed. None of the ships had any wind, so they couldn't move, at least not until late in the afternoon. It was too late to fight by that point, so the pirates made for the coast. The Spanish shifted to make sure they weren't up to anything, but they didn't stop the pirates. They wouldn't be able to get away on land, at least not from that bit of coastline, but all the pirates wanted was to put land at their back, just in case. On the third day of fighting, the 28th of May, the Spanish bore down on the pirate vessels. They got into range and opened fire, fully. The pirates got themselves in position and returned fire. Lusan writes, quote, "We fought till it was dark night. They very much shattered us, yet wounded but one man," end quote. The following day, the 29th, both sides held back, in the morning at least. That was just good form. After a day of engagement, it was good to give the other side time to get their rigging in order. That would give you time to get your rigging in order. After noon, though, the Spanish came in once again to attack that sloop of war, but one of the other ships in the pirate fleet rushed in to give aid, and this time, all of the vessels got in close. Now, the gunners fired the great guns over and over again, but there were men on deck employing their muskets as well, and neither side could get a man at the helm that could stand there for very long without a hail of musket shot coming at him and cutting him down. Now, Lusan claims that the pirates lost only one man through hours of concentrated fire, but the Spanish must have lost many more. Lusan knows this because of the torrent of blood-red water that flowed through the scupper holes. That is, of course, Lusan claiming once again that the pirates lost only 2 men in 2 days of fighting, but the Spanish had lost hundreds. I wonder what the men who had actually experienced naval combat at this time thought when they heard something like that. When the light finally failed, after another afternoon of fighting, the Spanish cried out, "A la mañana la partida." That is to say, good work, sleep well, I'll most likely kill you in the morning. The following day, both parties attempted to leave the bay. They wanted to pull back, but they both tried to pull back in the same direction. Both parties, both the Spanish and the pirates, prevented the other from doing so. There were a few rogue shots fired here and there, but most of them were warning shots to stay away. But the 31st of May saw another engagement. This time, the Spanish focused on the pirates' rigging. They had very little luck when they had attempted to attack the pirates on board, so if they could disable the vessels, they could, well, perhaps do other damage. They toppled 2 or 3 masts in that engagement. They ripped through sails and crossbeams and spoiled much of the pirates' tackle. So, rather than allow more damage to be done to their ships, Captain Picard made a decision. He ordered all the rest of the prisoners, the few that they had kept, brought up on deck. They were chained before the masts. They were tied up in the rigging. And finally, the ones that were left were lined up along the railing. I mean, that's dirty play. They would not be able to fire on these Spanish citizens. And these weren't just random Spanish citizens. They were the most valuable prisoners taken in Guayaquil. Bishops, merchants, the general of the forces of Guayaquil were there, blocking the Spanish from firing. So the Spanish backed off. In the night, the pirates set about work transferring the men and the guns from their most damaged vessel, the sloop, to other ships. While they were at work, the Spanish attempted a sneak attack to board the man-o-war, but the pirates weren't sleeping. They were all up and working, so the Spanish were repelled and backed off once again. The following day, the Spanish came back. This was the 7th day of fighting. This had been a full week of engaging one another on the sea. This time, the Spanish intended to board Bachelor's Delight. It was the largest and most dangerous of the pirate ships, and if they could board her and take her, well, the pirates would be forced to surrender. The pirates were less prepared this time than they had been the night before, so the Spanish were actually able to get one of their galleons in close to Bachelor's Delight and were sending out grapples to grab the pirate ship. But then, that man-o-war under Captain Picard swooped in and opened fire. Now, this was a close engagement, and the Spanish almost pulled it off. However, Captain Picard had outfitted another vessel, a long bark, to sneak alongside the Spanish galleon and to attempt a boarding of her own. That long bark did grapple the galleon, and even got a few men to climb aboard and fighting on deck. Now, the Spanish on board their galleon were much stronger than this boarding party, but they had a frigate and a man-o-war to deal with as well. They had their attention split 3 ways. They could have dealt with any one of those threats with no problem, but not all 3 of them at once. So they killed what boarders they could, and then cut loose and ran. The next morning, the 8th morning, the 2nd of June, there was another shooting engagement. The pirates and the Spanish fired at one another for hours, but the pirates were better with small arms than the Spanish were. Whenever they could get in close, they opened up with the muskets. They got so close at one point that the Spanish ships had to close their portholes and their gun batteries to barricade themselves within the ship. It was another long, bloody engagement. To hear Lusan tell it, the pirates lost basically no one and the Spanish lost basically everybody. But the following morning, the pirates awoke once again prepared to fight. But they found that Spanish armadillo was nowhere to be seen. Apparently, they had taken enough damage and enough injury and enough dead, so they fled. Now, Spain might have been able to take this battle the first day, the first hour of fighting, if they had been willing to do what was needed. They had the ships and the guns and the numbers, but The pirates had Spanish prisoners on board, important Spanish prisoners. They also had thousands of pieces of eight and untold other riches. If the Spanish did sail in force and overwhelm the pirates with all of their big guns, well, those Spanish dignitaries and all of the pieces of eight and all of the gold and all of the pearls and the gems, well, that would be sinking to the bottom of the bay. However, if they could keep the pirates from escaping, perhaps they could wear them down and be able to reclaim all of those dignitaries and treasures. And then, on the 31st, they were close to forcing the pirates to surrender. But Picard had that move with the prisoners in his back pocket, using them as human shields to guard their ships. Now, this was against the laws of war and good conduct and human decency, but it worked. So the pirates set sail from the Bay of Guayaquil. They left the bay and found a cove on the mainland in which they could lay anchor and count their plunder. The men who knew numbers and a bit of arithmetic, and were also trustworthy enough, gathered in a room full of treasure to inventory just how much they had taken. The Spanish records show only 50,000 pieces of eight being paid out to the pirates, and that might actually be true. That might be how much the government of Guayaquil paid to the pirates. But that doesn't include the treasure that was taken during those first days of plunder. Lusan tells us that they had somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 pieces of eight in assorted gold, silver, and gems. The pirates who were doing the counting actually stopped counting far before they had an accurate account. They decided it would be better to organize it by chests and sacks. Eventually, they stopped counting the silver altogether and chose to just distribute 400 pieces of eight to every pirate. Now, at first, when the pirates heard that news, they were upset. 400 pieces of eight wasn't much, and there is a lot more of it, so why aren't we getting it? Some of the men demanded that they go back to Cabo Blanco to see if their ransom had arrived. But Captain Picard cut them short. He said those two armadillas had been sent to pay us with cannonball. Then he gave the pirates the full news. This 400 pieces of eight was, well, it wasn't their share, it was a stipend. There was so much more, too much to count. Not just silver, but several hundred thousand in assorted indigo, dyes, all sorts of cargo, not to mention gold and gemstones and pearls. The gold was mostly uncoined. Any gold that was mined in Peru was sent to Lima, where they had a proper mint. That made it hard to weigh the gold for distribution. Similarly, the gemstones were uncut and difficult to give an accurate value to, so instead of handing out shares, they would hand out silver and allow the men an auction. They were allowed to bid on everything. Now, the pistols that they took in Guayaquil, which were apparently very fine pistols, sold at a base price of 15 pieces of eight each. Those sold immediately. But then the men bid on nuggets of gold and gemstones until every pirate in the fleet had what they wanted. Then they started gambling. Each of the pirates was in possession of more money than they had ever seen before. The pirates on board Bachelor's Delight doubled everything that they had earned so far on their voyage. Now, fortunes were being traded on the toss of a dice, and that was fine because they had plenty more. The drunk men were losing farms that they might have bought back in Port Royal or Cap Français. However, while all of this debauchery was going on deck, the assembled captains talked. Edward Davis was preparing to round South America, to return home to the West Indies, so he bartered out a deal with all of the other captains, with Pierre Le Picard and Mathurin de Marte and all of them. He wanted to buy any cargo that the other captains and crews might have. There was sugar and indigo and dyes and coffee. He wanted to buy that with silver and gold. See, Bachelor's Delight was the largest ship in the fleet. She had the biggest holds in the fleet, and she would actually be able to carry all of that valuable cargo. And then Captain Davis would be able to sell it when he returned home. And if he was clever, he would be able to earn even more money from it. So he traded the gold and gems for indigo, and coffee, and the other captains were happy to make that trade, not only because they wanted more gold and gems, they knew they might be able to sell it for more back home as well, but none of their ships were capable of making the trip around the Horn or through the Straits of Magellan. All of those pirates on their smaller vessels might have to abandon those ships and carry whatever plunder they had on their back. On 12 June 1687, Edward Davis set sail south. His first stop was to be the Galapagos, and then the Straits of Magellan, and then home. The rest of the pirates, all of them now assembled under Pierre Le Picard, decided instead to sail north. Now, they might have crossed through Darien. That seemed like the most likely option. But they didn't have any ships waiting for them on the other side of the isthmus. They wanted to know that they had a secure way home. They didn't want to wind up on the coast of the North Sea and be stuck there with sacks full of treasure and no way to spend it. So they ventured instead further west and further north until they were well into the waters of New Spain, even deep into the Gulf of California. Up there, they would find another group of French privateers, privateers that were legitimate privateers carrying letters of marque, that were much more in touch with civilization. Those new privateers actually recruited the crews of Captain Picard and all of the rest back into the fold for the next war with Spain, the 9 Years' War. There is a lot more raiding in their future, and we will return to the story of Pierre Le Picard and Ravenau de Lusson and Mathurin de Marte as they struggle to find their way home. Eventually, we will follow them as they return home, only to fight under and alongside Laurent de Graaf. And we will follow George Dew as well. George Dew was a longtime friend of these French pirates, but when the war breaks out, he is forced to make a decision, whether or not to stay with his friends or to fight with his countrymen on the other side of that war. And we will follow him when he meets his new compatriot, a man named William Kidd. But next time, we will be moving on from the story of the pirates in the Pacific. Actually, we'll be looking back. We're going to leave pirates and piracy behind for a little while. It's time to turn our eyes to Europe. Aside from a few forays here and there, we haven't looked much at Europe since the 30 Years' War. So next time, we're going to begin that look with the most powerful, the most famous, and the most influential figure in the world during the entire golden age of piracy, the Sun King, Louis XIV of France. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. I'd also like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, everybody who has become a patron on Patreon or given us a donation through the website, those of you who have spread the word about the show online or in real life, and those of you who have gotten in touch with me to share helpful information on pronunciation or facts I might not have been aware of. I appreciate all of that. And without all of you, I couldn't keep doing this, so thank you. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you have yet to check them out, I certainly suggest you do so over at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com, or you can get in touch on Twitter, SoundCloud, or YouTube. As always, most importantly, thank you for listening. Live on in legend tonight.